From Lansing Community College, this is LCC Connect, and this is Land Stories, with me, David Seawick. Each episode explores a different topic, such as the people, business, neighborhoods, communities, buildings, and other phenomena that make up the history of our college and our region. We tell stories, and in doing so, we connect the past to the present.
On and in this episode of Land Stories, we are looking at John McGough and the Pantex Corporation, as well as the 1986 Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush, a visit to McGough and Lansing for a fundraising event. The prior episode of Land Stories included background information on McGough and the Pantex Corporation, and McGough's developing business interests in South Africa. It is that latter point that brought protesters out to the airport to take task with the then vice president over soliciting campaign funds from a man with known ties to the South African government. And if you had a chance to listen to the last episode, you will recall that we did begin discussing the Pantex Corporation and John McGough and his ties to the South African government. If you have not had a chance to listen to that prior episode, I absolutely encourage you to do so. I will provide some summary of the previous show for those of you that have not had a chance to listen to that past episode. And of course, we are going to continue with our story. Now, this fascinating story involving a vice president of the United States and a local to Lansing, Michigan, businessman with ties to the South African government. In the prior episode, we did discuss something that is quite disturbing. And I will warn you ahead of time that in this episode, we are going to make reference to that as well. And that is reference to the Soweto Uprising in 1976. So please take caution while listening to this episode, because we are going to discuss some serious subject matter that involves violence perpetrated against children. On the last episode, we left off discussing that arrival of George Herbert Walker Bush to Lansing on the 16th of June, 1986, and I did mention a little bit about one of the reasons why that visit garnered the amount of protests that it did, and the biggest reason being McGough's ties to the South African government. Now, the United States Department of Justice eventually sets its eyes on John McGough and the Pantex Corporation, although it should be noted that specifically the Justice Department was pursuing McGough himself on potential criminal charges. Now, this case that was building, or that the Justice Department, I should more accurately say, was building against McGough was a complex case. And I speak about it, of course, in the past tense because it is a past event. After all, the events that we are talking about in this episode that are centered around the 1986 visit of George Herbert Walker Bush to Lansing and John McGough, the individual that Bush came to visit, very much focus on this corporation and the reason why Bush came here. But the South African business ties were quite complex. As I mentioned in the last episode, the Pantex Corporation in the early 1970s began investing money into South Africa. John McGough wanted to expand his business into South Africa. And this was a country that in the early 1970s, a lot of Western companies were investing into. Now, we discussed the protests who showed up to greet the vice president when he landed at the capital city airport on the 16th of June in 1986. And if you did not have a chance to listen to, again, the last episode, I did mention the Soweto Uprising, which occurred on June 16th, 1976. And that date is very important. It is, after all, the reason why on that date there were protesters that came out to the airport. June 16, 1976, in Soweto, South Africa, thousands of students ended up protesting in the street a decision by authorities to force children in South African schools to learn the Afrikaans language. And out of that protest, violence erupted and children were fired upon. There were children that were killed by the police officers. And in doing so, the Soweto Uprising brought the situation in South Africa, the apartheid regime, absolutely into the eyes and minds of people all around the world, including here in the United States. Now, after the Soweto Uprising, but certainly not only because of it, it's actually related to a lot of other things that were going on, both South Africa and elsewhere in the world at the time. The attention, however, on South Africa was ramped up after that and towards the apartheid regime that existed there. And it's really a combination of McGough's business interests in South Africa, as well as changing political ties that the South African government had to other international powers, countries such as the United States. And that is related to the situation in South Africa, more broadly speaking, and I should say Southern Africa with a small S, because we were talking about the region of the continent as a whole in the 1970s and into the 1980s. The Department of Justice pursuit centered around PANAC's expansion to South Africa, and in particular, PANAC established two subsidiary corporations in South Africa, having obtained loan guarantees and, according to the Department of Justice, money directly from the South African government. And again, partially in response to the 1976 Soweto uprising, but not entirely, by the 1980s, the United States government at the official level had started to apply pressure on the South African government to relent its apartheid policies. And in 1986, the United States government passed, through the Congress, the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act, a law that restricted commerce with South Africa, actually, and imposed a partial boycott on the nation. That law came about at a time where there was a tremendous amount of public pressure on corporations here in the United States and elsewhere that have been doing business in South Africa, and therefore that were seen as in some ways supporting the apartheid regime, to cease their operations in South Africa. And the culmination, therefore, of legal challenges to the South African apartheid regime, as well as a tremendous amount of public pressure, did make a big impact in South Africa, actually. Now, the 1986 law that Congress passed, the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act, again, it restricted commerce to South Africa, but the United States State Department looked at the South African government under quite different circumstances than the U.S. Congress did in passing the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act. The State Department, so this is the part of the government that deals with international relations and international affairs, looked at the South African government actually quite favorably. And the reason for that is because in the 1970s and into the 1980s, the time frame that this episode covers, the Cold War was still going on. And the Cold War had battlefronts, as it turns out, in and on the continent of Africa, actually all around Africa. There were nations that fought each other during the Cold War that had direct or indirect, in some cases, covert support from the United States government, because the overarching operating mindset that the United States State Department had throughout the Cold War was to divide the world up essentially into two spheres. One sphere being those nations that were allied with the West, the United States being the center of that alliance. And these were nations that, at least in declaration anyways, did not have communist governments, and had economic systems that more or less functioned similar to the American capitalist free enterprise system. Now, in the world after the Second World War, the Soviet Union spread its influence and established its own sphere of influence around the world in nations that had adopted communist governments. And oftentimes communist governments had come into existence in nations that were undergoing the decolonialization efforts that spread in places like Africa that had been centers of European colonial influence in the decades and the centuries prior to when we get to the 1970s and 1980s. So there is a lot going on in and on the continent of Africa. And the U.S. Department of State looks at South Africa and it looks at the civil war going on in Angola next door. It looks at the spread of regimes that are either communist or make a statement as much among South Africa's neighbors, and it sees the South African government, in spite of its very oppressive regime and policies domestically, as a useful American ally. And in fact, even up to the point where the international community recognized that South Africa illegally occupied Namibia, and the U.S. State Department really turned a blind eye to that because they viewed the South African alliance as a bulwark against communism. So, with all that said, the PANAC Corporation, John McGough, being the person who founded it, placed itself by investing into South Africa in the 1970s, right in the middle of major international political and military developments. Now, the U.S. Department of Justice began their pursuit of Magoff sometime in the late 70s or early 1980s, definitely years before the passage of the Comprehensive Anti-Apartheid Act in 1986. Now, the U.S. Department of Justice was looking at pressing charges against Magoff for accepting money from a foreign government for the purposes of purchasing American media outlets. And Magoff stood accused of this, in particular, the attempt that Goff made to purchase two newspapers, the newspaper in Sacramento, California, and then Washington, D.C. These are the business transactions that ended up throwing red flags up because they had potentially involved the South African government. Accepting money from a foreign government for the purpose of purchasing the media outlets in the manner by which Magoff stood did indeed have the potential to run afoul with other statutes that were on the books at the time. Some of them are still on the books, actually, that attempt to limit foreign influence in American affairs. It must be noted in all of this a consideration of the legal problems that Magoff may have faced that the word may is important to keep in mind because Magoff was never actually charged. He wasn't. As such, it's difficult to determine with great accuracy what the charges might have been, but nonetheless, there were a plethora of public records and public documents, as well as media reports, produced at the time surrounding the case, and it appears, reading through those, that the Justice Department's case is very much centered around Magoff's South African operations. We've already discussed those. And if any ties existed that the Department of Justice could directly peg of money having been accepted from the South African government going to purchase these American newspapers. To accept money flat out from a foreign state or foreign government without registering with the U.S. Department of State was, according to the Department of Justice, violation of U.S. law. So it appears that Magoff was facing a federal indictment on charges of accepting $13.5 million from South Africa through the Panax Corporation and its South African interests. In fact, the U.S. Department of Justice even issued a 700-page memo outlining the evidence that they had been gathering against Magoff. And it is from that sourcing that we are able to piece together now what would have been the case had the U.S. Department of Justice actually formally indicted him. But again, he wasn't actually indicted. The government dropped the charges against Magoff, citing statute of limitations on the laws that he had been investigated under. So even before, though, the case that the Department of Justice was building against Magoff ended up being dropped, Magoff's business interests and the Panax Corporation itself were on the downhill slope in terms of the business cycle and the life of that corporation. Magoff actually drew his corporation down by liquidating his assets. Magoff actually sat down for quite an extensive interview to a journalism major at Michigan State University. Actually, she did pursue her master's degree in journalism at Michigan State University, and she wrote her master's thesis on the Magoff Corporation. And therefore, the interview that Magoff, actually it was more than one interview, that Magoff sat down and submitted to for the semi thesis ended up being a tremendous source for the research I conducted to put the show together. And the prior episode of Land Stories that discussed Magoff, I did bring into that episode a little bit of the research methodology in terms of putting the show together and the difference between the way a historian would approach a topic such as this, looking at it from the viewpoint of the past. After all, this happened now almost 40 years ago, and some of the events I've been discussing in this episode and the prior one actually happened over 50 years ago, and some of them, well, they go well back into the middle part of the 20th century. And when a historian looks at subject matter such as this, he approaches it a little bit differently than the way a journalist might. And I was able to, again, locate a plethora of sources in investigating the Magoff story. And in the interviews that Magoff submitted that I made reference to here, a minute or so ago, he talked about how he drew his company down primarily because of, even back in the 1970s and early 1980s, McGough recognized that there were changes in the media market, changes to the way that television was going to be distributed, changes to the way radio would serve as a form of media, the way it changes the way people would listen to radio, the way companies operate radio stations. And McGough also discussed, again, in the interviews that he submitted for this MA thesis that was wrote, that the newspaper business was changing as well. And so by the early 1980s, even, McGough had actually divested himself of many of the companies that he had either acquired or purchased previously as part of the Panax Corporation, or in some cases, those he had started himself, and even liquidating his assets to overseas companies, for example. Some of McGough's newspapers ended up falling in the hands of a British media company out of Liverpool, England, to give you an idea of what the dismantling of his assets looked like. Now, according to contemporary media accounts, on the day of the George H.W. Bush visit to Lansing, that would be the 16th of June of 1986, there were about 24 protesters that came out to the event, and some of them came from the Peace Education Center in East Lansing. The Peace Education Center was founded in the 1960s as part of a nationwide movement to end the Vietnam War and promote peace initiatives around the world. And the Peace Education Center in East Lansing is still in existence. It still promotes peace around the world. At the time, two folks from that organization ended up being interviewed by the local media outlets to cover the visit of Vice President Bush to Lansing, and of course, to cover the protests that were there. Carrie Potter, who was with the Peace Education Center in East Lansing at the time, was even quoted in a contemporary article that I read in researching the story as having held up a sign that was intended to be read by the Vice President of the United States that said, "The Vice President of the United States has no business meeting with friends of the South African government on the anniversary of Soweto." So it was very obvious, or at least the people that were involved in the protests at the time tried to make it very obvious, that the purpose of them greeting the vice president's plane, or at least that's what they hoped to do, as it landed in Lansing, Michigan, was to bring attention to the general public that the vice president was coming to Lansing to meet with somebody who was being investigated by the U.S. Department of Justice at the time for his ties to the South African government. And by the time we get to 1986, apartheid is a major, major international issue that people are trying and working very hard to bring to an end in South Africa. So that is why, ultimately, folks from the Peace Education Center in East Lansing showed up, people like Carrie Potter, to hold up signs and shout and do other things to express their protests of the vice presidential visit. Now, Bush and McGough certainly had financial ties. We know this from records made public. We know it from contemporary reporting at the time. McGough didn't hide his ties to the Republican Party and his efforts to raise money for Republican candidates or to advocate for them. And he had worked for decades, actually, to become one of the Republican Party's most well-respected financial donors. He bragged, actually, about the influences newspapers had over local politics, and in some cases, state and national politics, even suggesting that his ownership and influence over the editorial page of the Macomb Daily newspaper might have even helped Robert Griffin, or could have even been responsible for Robert Griffin being elected to the Senate. So that's a pretty bold statement for somebody to make. But I think that when somebody makes a statement like that, it suggests that he has the confidence in it, for one, and that confidence, one could guess, had been garnered from at least what he believed to be evidence. And, well, Robert Griffin's election to the Senate would have provided such evidence. McGough himself, again, never being charged with any of the crimes that the Department of Justice had been pursuing against him. John McGough's business empire, however, we would not at all be accurate to say it was resigned to a faded memory, even though the Pandax Corporation ceased to exist in anything that resembled the form that McGough had established it in, well before, actually, even McGough passed away. His newspapers that he at one time owned, Many of them are still around, including some newspapers in Michigan. The same is true with printing facilities and radio stations that were once part of the Pantex Corporation. McGough himself passed away in Charlevoix, Michigan on January the 21st, 1998, at the age of 73. His lasting legacy on the Lansing area, on Michigan, on the United States, really on the world as a whole, I think is certainly much found in the impact that he had on all the media outlets that he at one time owned or had a hand in. And that, of course, has an impact that I think is very difficult to judge, because if one thinks about all of the folks that have read articles or listened to radio stations or watched programming on TV stations that had a connection to the Pantex Corporation at one time, I think it's pretty easy for one to conclude that an influence, or the influence of a person like John McGough and all of the impact that he had on other people, other companies, while he was alive is maybe, too hard to judge the extent of it thereof. When John McGough died, the New York Times published an obituary of his life, and in it had made two particular mentions about what it believed would be McGough's lasting legacy on the world. And both of those mentions were his company with its media ties and his lucrative donations that he had given to the Republican Party during his time. That, therefore, is the story of John McGough and the Pantex Corporation and the June 16th, 1986 visit of then Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush to Lansing.
You've been listening to Land Stories with me, David Seawick. For more information on this program and to stream past episodes, visit lccconnect.org. LCC Connect is the official home of the voices, vibes, and vision of Lansing Community College, offering hours of original and exciting programming. Hosted by faculty, staff, and community members, LCC Connect explores our college's work in the community, important topics in higher education, and our vision for the future. Catch the vibe on 89.7 FM or online at lccconnect.org. Until next time, remember, keep telling good stories.